Good morning. I'm Ron Turco. I'm at Purdue University, and I'm your moderator today for this session. This is something I'm personally particularly excited about as an area of research, so I was happy to get asked to sort of help set this up, and then with my colleague, Veronica Costa-Martinez, sitting right here. Veronica did all the work, of course. We got this organized, and I think it's going to be a really nice session. So thank you, Veronica, for helping on this. The Soil Science Society and the Entomology Society are co-sponsoring, along with the Crop Science Society. So it's a very joint effort on this. So at the start out today, we're going to hear first from Jan Leach. And she's the Associate Dean of Research at the College of Agriculture. She's a University Distinguished Professor at Colorado State University. And she's worked all around the world. She's worked in rice in the Philippines. She's worked with all types of plant pathogen interactions, and she's become a kind of a leader, centralizing force in this whole area of the plant biome and soil biome. So we're really happy to have Jan talk this morning. So Jan.
Well, good morning. It's bright and early and starting off the week of a busy meeting. I appreciate y'all being here and I appreciate the invitation to speak. This is a topic that we're very excited about, and we launched an initiative with the American Phytopath Society on phytobiomes. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, because this is an initiative that's way bigger than just us, and it's going to involve the whole of the agricultural community, we hope. So, to define phytobiomes, because I know there's a lot of confusion about what the term means, we define it as all organisms living in, on, or around plants, and that includes not only the microbes, the soil microbiome, bacteria, fungi, nematodes, but it also includes animals such as insects and other organisms, and other plants, plant-plant interactions, because in an ecosystem, in an agroecosystem, you don't just have plants interacting with microbes or soil. But importantly, it also encompasses the environment, such as drought or sunshine or water, which are critical factors in how this phytobiome functions. We see this phytobiome as a system, and the goal of the initiative that we're promoting is that by 2025, we want to build a foundation for the comprehensive understanding of phytobiomes to improve crop productivity. We want to know how these phytobiome components, such as the microbes or the plants or the insects, influence or are influenced by the plant or the plant environment. And all of this needs to be taken in context, and I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. We also are interested in particularly, and this is what makes this initiative distinct from the microbiome initiatives that you see out there, is we want to find out how that information can be used to improve crop productivity, quality, nutrition, safety, and security. So this initiative is focused on agriculture. So where are we starting? Well, we know that we're building on the backs of giants, and there's a rich history of information out there where people have looked at how microbes, in particular, help plants defend themselves. For example, it's well known that bacteria in the soil, in the rhizosphere, can induce in plants a systemic resistance response that helps protect plants against pathogens. We also know that microbes help plants acquire nutrients and water. In particular, if we look at mycorrhizae, in this picture, the sort of the halo around the roots or the mycorrhizae help the plant take up phosphorus, nitrogen, zinc, and water because they expand the root space of the plants. And the plant, in turn, feeds the mycorrhizae up to 20% of its photosynthate. We know that microbes moderate effects of drought, flooding, and salinity. And we know, in some cases, the mechanisms of how they do that. So microbes can enhance root growth to get the roots down into the soil, into where there's richer moisture, by producing phytohormones that stimulate root growth. We know that microbes can minimize the inhibitory effect of ethylene on plant growth, again stimulating plant growth, and that microbes can form biofilms around roots to reduce the ion movement, so the uptake of salts into the roots. So these are just a few examples about how these microbiomes fit into the system. But in most of the studies that we've undertaken so far, we've looked only at one microbe or a few, and we haven't really paid attention to the communities because we really haven't had the capacity to do that. We've also looked only at cultured organisms, and we know, for example, that much of the soil microbiota and possibly animals in the soil are not culturable. We've also studied these in one plant, one microbe, or one stress, like drought stress in the plant, or what, maybe even drought stress with a microbe in association with it. But we really have not looked at this as a whole system. And this is very much like the old Indian story about the blind men who were asked to describe what does an elephant look like. So if the person who grabbed the tail of the elephant said, well, you know, an elephant looks like a rope. And if you grab its tusk, you think it looks like a spear. Or you grab its ear, and you think it looks like a fan. So if we don't think about this system, this phytobiome system, in its context, in the whole system, we're only getting part of the picture, and therefore part of the answers that we need to apply for crop improvement and productivity. And we know that in some cases the systems are what's important. And in this particular case, where they looked at suppressive soils. So these soils, when you plant plants in them, will suppress disease and, in fact, can control diseases in some situations if in context. But it's the communities of the microbes, not just one or a few, that are important in this interaction. So why are we thinking that now is the time for a phytobiome initiative? We've had huge improvements in systems-level approaches. We've had high-throughput sequencing that now can very cheaply look at many, many samples, so we can indeed study at least components, the genomes of these organisms in context. We've also had improvements in the networking capacity. We can model these systems better. We can do data analytics and tremendous power behind these data analytics. We've gained from the progress of the human microbiome studies. We now know, for example, that we can take what we learned from the microbiome and apply it. One of the prime examples that's being used routinely now are fecal implants. And as disgusting as it is, it works. And it's because it's a community of microbes that they're implanting and not one or a few. They're trying to tease that apart and understand which ones are important. But in reality, it's this community of organisms that's important. In Science and Nature, a few weeks ago, you saw a call for a unified effort for the microbiome, Earth microbiomes. And in fact, the Office of Science and Technology Policy will be launching a report any day now. In fact, it may be out now, that describes from the President's office an interest in moving microbiome research forward. I will tell you that the funding for microbiomes is big, but about 33% of it goes to the human microbiome, and agriculture gets 8% of the budget. It's something like $900 billion, but agriculture gets a very tiny slice of that budget. And yet we have to feed those people that they're keeping alive. We've also seen improvement in management strategies, precision agriculture, data-driven agriculture, and this, in fact, will rely on the information that we can pull in from the microbiomes and the phytobiome. So just to give you a few examples of the progress that has been made or the application from the human microbiome, For example, we now know that, just very recent studies, we now know that gut bacteria can predict whether or not children will get asthma. We also, if you choose to believe it, know that the gut microbiome, in fact, impacts our personality. We also know from just a very recent study that we shed a cloud of microbes wherever we go, and they likened it in the story to Pigpen from the Charlie Brown stories, whereas he walked around shedding dirt. In fact, he's also shedding microbes as we move around. So we're impacting each other without even knowing it by the microbes that we shed. And we also know that microbes will change our brain function. So as your mom used to say to you, at least my mom said to me, you are what you eat. And maybe you think you're going to have the garden salad, but your gut is telling you, I really would rather have the cheeseburger and fries. Now, while I just want to diverge a little bit and say, yes, the garden salad sounds very good for you and healthy, but we also have food safety issues that are related to the organisms associated with plants. And that garden salad may be loaded with human pathogens. So it may not be quite as good for you as Mom wanted us to believe. So I'm going to spend part of this talk, although I said that the phytobiome is inclusive, and it includes much more than the plant microbiome interacting with the plant. But we have a lot of good examples from the plant microbiome. So I'm going to diverge a little bit and talk about some of the findings from that. But first, I'll give you a very brief description of how we assess that, just to bring you up to speed with that in case you're not familiar. So one of the things that we can do now is we can understand who's in a community of organisms. And we can do that by simply taking, for example, a gram of soil, extracting the DNA in mass from that soil, and you can either do sequence, amplify and sequence small housekeeping genes from that, or things like the 16S or 18S RNA if it's a eukaryote. And then from that, you can determine who's in that community. Or you can actually sequence the whole genome in mass of all the organisms that are in the soil, and that will in fact tell you what they can do. What's the genetic potential of that community? Or if you want to know what they're actually doing, you can do metatranscriptome sequencing, which enables you to look at what genes are transcribed, and that tells you presumably what might be going on in the soil or in the plant. And also you can do metaproteome or metabolome analyses, which tell you what is actually transcribed and or translated and then turned into metabolites. So in other words, we're asking who's there, what is their potential, and what are they doing? So it's not as simple as it sounds. I mean, this is a study that was published in 2013 where she took a tomato plant grown in a greenhouse in Virginia, and she took it down to its pieces parts. And she asked, what are the microbial communities? And she looked at both bacterial and fungal. This picture is just the bacterial communities. On the surface of the leaves, on the top leaves, on the tomatoes, the fruits themselves, and in the soil. And you don't need to know who they are, but if you look at the pie charts on this graph, you can see that the top leaves, the communities in the top leaves, are very different than the communities in the bottom leaves down here. There's a lot of overlap, but the proportions and even some of the microbes are quite different in those communities. Not only that, but if you look at the fruit versus the roots, they're just tremendously different. So it's complex. It's not as simple as taking a plant and grinding it up, because the root communities are going to have entirely different functions and purposes than the communities on the shoots. And the communities apparently on the flowers and fruits have different proportions of organisms than on the other parts of the plants. But what it does, what these technologies do, is they allow us to ask some very fundamental questions that are going to be important for us for the future. And one of them is, do plants control the microbiome composition? Is there a genetic role for the plants in this? So I'm lumping a bunch of studies together here where people took DNA from seed, from the rhizosphere, the part of the soil that's right up against the root that's influenced by the root, the endophytic compartments, the parts of the plant inside the plant, and also from the soils that are outside the rhizosphere. And they looked at what microbes might be there. They looked at who's there. And what they found in general is that plants absolutely regulate the entry of bacteria. And this is plant genotype dependent. So when the microbes are coming in closer to the plant as they're attracted to the rhizosphere, the plant can selectively take up microbes and internalize them into the plant. So the endophytic compartment is genetically regulated. They also found in some studies that geographically distinct soils contribute taxonomically similar bacterial endophytes. So while the plant regulates what it takes up, there are microbes that it particularly selects from different soil types. And these are the same microbes regardless of the soil type. And then they also demonstrated that plants can transmit bacterial endophytes via seed. So you can move seed from Mexico, plant it in Canada, and you will carry endophytic microbes with it that are common. So why do we care about this? Well, first of all, the fact that the plant has genetics determine what microbes are taken up by the plant means that we can breed plants to select for healthy microbiomes, or we can breed plants accidentally that are not healthy. The microbiomes that they select or support are not healthy. So the question, one major question is, have we inadvertently, through our breeding practices where we apply high nitrogen, high phosphorus, selected away from plants that the microbe-associated communities of plants? In wheat, for example, years ago, a mycorrhizal friend of mine told me that in domestication of wheat, we selected away from mycorrhizal associations in wheat, and now we have to add the chemicals. So can we breed for plants that don't require as many inputs? And can we also identify more successful biocontrol agents? One of the major problems with biocontrol in, for example, plant disease, is that you take a microbe out of soil in one state or country and you move that microbe alone to another place, and it's out of its element, it's in a completely foreign community, and it doesn't know what to do. And so biocontrol has failed miserably in many examples because we don't think about the community. We've thought about one or a few microbes or organisms. So I'd like to just use this example of the influence of plant disease on microbiomes. And in this particular case, they looked at the citrus greening disease, which is a horrible problem for those of us who love orange juice, because it's devastating the citrus industry in the citrus-growing parts of the United States and other countries. And what they did is they did amplicon sequencing of the rhizosphere of trees that were infected with the disease and healthy trees and compared them. And what they found is that the microbiomes, or the rhizosphere microbiome in the healthy trees, was very distinct from the rhizosphere microbiome of the infected or diseased trees. And in fact, these microbiome shifts are diagnostic for the disease because there's such a consistent shift in the microbiota. But what they also found, and it's helping us to begin to understand how the microbiome responds to disease, is that there was a shift in the potential, the genetic potential, or the functional portion of the microbiota. The genes in that community were now shifted away from those that use easily degraded carbons, such as starch and hemicellulose, to those that were now targeted toward recalcitrant carbon sources, such as chitin and lignin. And this is particularly consistent with a shift in the photosynthetic pathways and the drive of the photosynthates into the roots. So I know you're going to hear from Gary in a minute, but I'd like to pitch this because I think this is a particularly exciting project, that insects and microbes and plants interact. So again, thinking more holistically, not just insects and plants, but looking at this community of organisms that work together. And what we'll learn is that bacteria associated with certain insects, like the Colorado beetle, can manipulate plant defenses to facilitate beetle feeding. Now, why do we care about that? It's very interesting biologically. We care because maybe we should be breeding to the for resistance to the bacteria and not the insect. It might be simpler to breed for that bacteria that's actually reducing the plant response to the insect so that the insect can feed. So there are lots of other stories out there, and in fact, it's increasing very rapidly what we're learning about the plant and its associated communities. And in fact, I mentioned harness the Earth's microbiome in order to improve agriculture. But what are some of the ideas for what we can do for the future? I've alluded to a few of them, but maybe we can think about using the phytobiome as a system to understand or develop management strategies that create disease-suppressive soils with microbial communities appropriate. Or can we breed plants or engineer plants that select for and maintain these beneficial microbiomes? Or can we manage or engineer microbiomes that promote sustained crop productivity? Can we rebuild depleted soils? For example, 1.5 billion people in the world depend on depleted soils for their survival. And in this meeting, I don't think I need to tell you about how bad this problem is. Or can we manage or engineer microbiomes that produce crops with less water? In fact, knowing what they can do to help that community. Or a phytobiome that helps us produce under changing climate conditions, higher temperatures. We know that associated organisms can help plants produce better under higher temperature conditions. Or can we develop organisms that detect and treat or destroy plant pathogens or pests? This is an example from our work of a high-throughput field phenotyping system. Because we have these tools now, we can now breed for crops that are in a healthy or bad phytobiome and use this as a selection process for these crops. But we need more of these. And in fact, you're noticing that this is all at the upper plant part. We don't have the capacity to do high-throughput phenotyping in the soil. Not yet. But that is a target, for example, of DOE and ARPA-E. The system, by the way, can screen 200 plots an hour, where the graduate student with the measuring stick and all the other devices takes a lot longer. This is a slide I borrowed from my colleague, Raj Khosla, who is interested in precision agriculture. Maybe if we understand all of this information and integrate it. Now, this is one of the huge tasks for the future, is how do we take all these disparate types of data, including the biota, how do we take all that information and put it into a format where a farmer can put the inputs on a per area basis, so he can plant the right seed with the right inputs at the right time at the right place. So understanding and applications of phytobiomes to agriculture requires interdisciplinary approaches. We have to have the computational biologists. We have to have the engineers to develop the tools. We have to have the plant pathologist, the microbiologist, the soil scientist, the agronomist, and we have to think about these things in context. We can't just look at one part of that system and think we have the answer. So what are we doing in the Phytobiomes Initiative now? I'll just give you a very quick update. We're developing a roadmap. We were funded by several funding agencies to develop a roadmap for the future. I just, on Friday, gave a congressional seminar and a Senate seminar pitching that we need money for this area, and it has to be new money. It can't be taking money from all what little money already is in agriculture and applying it to this. And so we're continuing those efforts. We are in the process of building an international consortium, and that we hope will work to facilitate industry-public relationships. And we've had industry already signing on to this because they see the advantage. Think about how many industries you know now are looking at biotic interactions. Bayer has a biologics, Novozymes. They understand that in order for their products to last or do their thing in the field, in the future may require the biological inputs and rational biological inputs. We also want to, of course, develop a cross-trained workforce, because now we're talking at a systems level. Systems biology requires that we think across barriers of disciplines. And we need the young students and postdocs that are trained in order to do that. And again, we're advocating for new funding. And we're trying to get people to talk to each other rationally. You know how hard it is to find pictures of President Obama with this young man who is now the Speaker of the House? And I couldn't find one shaking hands. So where are we going in the future? So besides the advocacy for funding, we've engaged in a lot of different venues for presentations, such as you guys are hearing here. There will be a rollout, we hope, of the roadmap in Washington, D.C. in March, and we hope that that garners the attention to bring funding, new funding, into the area, as well as new researchers into the area. We have meetings coming up at the Plant and Animal Genome Meeting and also at the APS, the American Phytopathological Society annual meeting. And also Keystone Symposia invited us to develop a symposium on phytobiomes, which will be held in Brazil next year. So finally, I'd like to acknowledge my partners in this. This initiative was started by the American Phytopathological Society, but it is way beyond us now, and hopefully it will continue to go way beyond us. I have to acknowledge funding sources, not only APS, but the Noble Foundation, who hugely supported some of the roadmap work, NIFA, NSF, the Forest Service, and Bayer Crop Science for funding meetings and roadmap development, and then my partners, Gwen Beatty and Kelly Eversole, who have helped pull this together, but also our partners so far in the initiative, and we're continuing to look for partners that will help us push this initiative in Washington and internationally as well. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
You mentioned that it might be possible for green plants to select better microbiomes. I'm curious if there is enough of these beneficial microbes in conventional agriculture to make it worth breeding for, and under what conditions you would be able to use them.
So the question, as I understand it, is that if we intend to breed for healthy microbiomes, are those microbes out there that we can select the plants against in conventional agriculture? And I would bet they are, but we may have driven them down. For example, an example I can think of is a friend of mine told me in Africa there are some soils that are horrendously depleted, but there are certain shrubs that grow very well in these soils, and the soil around those shrubs is extremely healthy. So one question would be, has this shrub sequestered those soils? But we may have to start our breeding practices without putting inputs in. I think that would be the thing that we would have to do. But it's a very good question. Yeah, thank you. So the question is, we know that plants take up microbes in a genotype-dependent way, but do they also take up other microbes? And if it's a different strain, and that's absolutely true. We know that genotype-dependent uptake is important in certain for certain microbes, but there are other microbes that get in independent of the host genotype. And those, in some certain cases, could be disease-causing organisms or beneficial organisms as well. Yeah. But they absolutely, there is a microbe genotype part of that, too.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you.